So if you were to go back to I-69 and draw a line directly south until you hit the Ohio River, that's where I grew up. A little tiny town called Vivi in southeast Indiana. I started to say southeast Urbana, but I live in Urbana in southeast Urbana now. But that is my hometown. You can see it in that photo, not very big. The bottom left is the library, and I grew up on the same block as the library in town, and I thought that was like incredibly fortunate. There were only a couple of homes on that block, and one of them was mine, and not only that, but the house I grew up in looked almost exactly like this. Same brick, same red tile roof. The only two buildings in town with that color brick and that kind of roof. And I was convinced that that was some sort of destiny, even as a kid. And I was at the library every day of the week that it was open, except for Saturday. And on Saturday, I walked down one block further to Sullivan's Drugstore, which is now the visitor center in town. Sullivan's Drugstore was where I sat on the cold tile floor in front of the magazine rack and looked through all of the comics that I could on Saturday mornings. That's all I wanted to do, was thumb through the comic books. This was the early 1970s, the era of Richie Rich and Archie and not very good kids comics, but it worked. And so I would usually buy something. When I got older, I went to library school and graduated and became a high school librarian. And one of the things I began to realize is that there were no comics in the high school library when I started working there. And that was really the first time I had had that realization. This was the early 1990s. It was the first time I'd had that realization that growing up, I had to go to two different places to get the stuff that I wanted to read. I could find a lot of it at the library, but there was this other chunk of stuff, comics, that I had to go to a drugstore. I mean, what's up with that? Why a drugstore? And so I began to think about why there was that division. And I began to buy comics for the library where I worked. And when I went back to get my doctorate a few years later, I really began to think about what caused that division. Why weren't there comics in libraries? Comics have been around for a long time. So even when I started back in the doctorate program, a lot of public libraries didn't have comics. And academic libraries didn't have comics for the most part. And I really began to think about those issues. Now today, we're fortunate. We've got beautiful comics of all kinds. Not just the floppy kinds, but web comics and manga, graphic novels, beautiful stuff for kids. Some things on the screen here from folks who will be here this weekend. We have a wealth of programming, a wealth of awards that link comics and libraries. It's pretty cool. You can go into almost any library, school, public, academic library today and find an awesome comics collection. Maybe not as awesome as the one on the second floor here, but still pretty awesome. You can find comics-related programming at library conferences, and you can find library-related programming at comics conferences. You can find awards given to comics from different parts of the library world. And you see other recognition too. So this past winter was a big year for comics in the library world because this one summer and El Defo were both given awards at the Midwinter Conference. You see things like the big librarian group photo at C2E2 in Chicago, where the American Library Association has a booth set up. And it's even crossed over into the mainstream world. I mean, anytime you get the Wall Street Journal writing not only about comics, but about kids' comics, and about someone as cool as Raina Telgemeier, that's pretty awesome. And then, of course, there's this, why we're all here today. This kind of library education comics nexus wouldn't have occurred even 10 years ago, and definitely not when I was growing up in the early 1970s. Now, it may be tempting to think of today as sort of the golden age, this wonderful sort of surge in comics and libraries and classrooms and kids, But what I want to talk with you about today is really the golden age that once was and that we kind of screwed up as teachers and librarians and as parents and adults more generally. And I want to share with you some of what I call the secret history of comics readers, of kids and comics from the 1930s, the 1940s, and the 1950s. Now, if we were to go back in time a little more than half a century ago, we would have found kids reading comics everywhere, and all kids, and all kinds of comics. Now, this middle image, the biggest one, is not a Norman Rockwell painting, although it might look like it. This is a photograph from about 1948. I've dated some of the comics on the newsstand. You can see the kids, you can see all of those comics. I mean, look at that. By the early 1950s, there were 600 different comics titles published regularly in the United States. And these kids were taking advantage of some of that wealth of titles that they had available. You can see in some of the other photos that it wasn't just white middle-class kids, it wasn't just boys. The top left photo, those are kids at one of the Japanese internment camps at a newsstand reading comics. You see some young men in Harlem in the late 1930s with their comic books. You see girls squatting on the floor in a drugstore. So there were all kinds of kids reading all kinds of comics. In fact, by the early 1940s, the best estimate was, and it's pretty well corroborated with research, is that 95 to 96% of all kids read comics regularly. Now, I think any of us today would be excited about that. 95 or 96% of kids reading anything that they aren't required to for school. But this was all voluntary reading. By the time these kids became teenagers, that number fell a little bit. It was down to maybe 85%, but that's still pretty respectable. And when you got to adults as comics readers, it was somewhere around between 40 and 60%. So again, still pretty respectable. And it wasn't just that these kids were reading one or two comics. The average young person during this time was following maybe 20 different comic titles. That was in book form. They were following an equal number in newspaper comic strips. Imagine that. Kids were reading the newspaper. Kids were reading the newspaper so they could read comics. Now, adults were reading the newspaper comics a lot too, but these kids were reading a lot of comics. If you look at some of the reading surveys from this time period, there are some kids who are reading 50 or 60 different comic books regularly. And that was pretty easy to do because, like I said, there were at the peak about 600 different comics titles being published regularly. It didn't matter what your socioeconomic status was, what your sort of school level was when leveling was still big in school. It didn't matter whether you were a slow student or a star student. It didn't matter if you were black or white or brown. You were a comics reader. And even early on, there were lots of different kinds of comics to choose from. Comic books as a thing, as a form of material culture, got their start in the early to mid-1930s. They really got their start after Superman was introduced in Action Comics in 1938. But even early on, there was a diversity in the kinds of stories being told in comics. Maybe not a diversity in the way we might think of it today. There were lots of racial stereotypes. There was lots of ugliness of different kinds in comics. But you could find a lot of different genres, a lot of different formats. You could find even things like classic literature retold in comics, not just in Classics Illustrated, which many of you may be familiar with, but even in the pages of everyday comic books, you could find stories like Treasure Island and The Count of Monte Cristo retold in serialized comics form. When the first guesstimates of comic sales were made, now, publishers were never very good about releasing their sales figures because they considered that proprietary. They didn't want anyone to know exactly what they were doing. But in 1940, so 2 years after Superman, a woman by the name of Louise Bechtel, who was a children's literature authority, wrote that comics were selling $10 million worth of materials a year. That's 10 cents a piece. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but this is 1940. $10 million was a lot of comics. At the same time, children's literature, children's books in general, $2 million. The average children's book in 1940 cost around $2 compared to the 10 cents for a comic book. Comics were already outselling children's books monetarily by 5 to 1 in 1940, and that gap continued to grow. Comics continued to grow and change too, so that after World War II, as GIs began to come back into mainstream American life, publishers were trying to figure out how to keep those readers interested in what they were putting out. Because a lot of folks who had gone off to fight in World War II were also comics readers. There were kids who were beginning to age out of the comics they read as elementary school students or young teens, and they needed something more exciting. They needed something that, you know, maybe wasn't Donald Duck. And so publishers began to experiment with things like horror and mystery and supernatural and war and crime and sexy lady comics and a whole host of others. And that drove sales up even more. So that by the late 1940s, comics were selling about 60 million issues a month. That wasn't even the peak. The peak came in about 1953 when comics were selling 1 billion new issues a year in the United States. 1 billion. That's about 30 comics for every person who is alive in the United States at that point in time. We're not even close to that now. I'll show you a little bit later. You can see how different that is. But it was about this time that a lot of adults began to get really nervous about comics. You can imagine seeing some of the stuff, your kids bringing it home, that maybe you would wonder what it is they're spending their time with. And we'll get back to that in a couple of minutes. But I want to talk about what kids were doing with comics. They weren't just reading them. One of the things they were doing with comics was playing with them. And this is really important. I think a lot of times we tend to think that this sort of commercial culture that we associate with contemporary life is a result of or a consequence of contemporary life. But we've been commercializing comics since 1904 with Buster Brown and some of the early newspaper comic strips. And so by the 1930s and 40s and 50s, there were all kinds of toys, clothing, memorabilia, tie-ins, advertising that drew on comic characters that kids were exposed to. So you might be able to wear your Superman sweatshirt and play with your Superman ray gun and play with paper dolls that you found in comics. You can see this is a McCall sewing pattern for little Lulu. I mean, there was this kind of stuff everywhere. You could listen to some comics-related serials on the radio or go to the movies and see even more comics-related serials. So kids were really immersed in this stuff. They were reading lots of comics. They were playing with comics. And they were also beginning to engage with comics in sort of novel ways. Now, if you are crass or a little cynical, you can say, well, these are just examples of how comics publishers were trying to get kids to buy stuff by printing their names in the pages of comics. And so that's probably partly true. But kids were starting to write to comics. So even in the early 1940s, there were letters pages in some comics. This is from 1940. So Fawcett Comics early on had pen pals pages. And these were really cool because you can see that it was divided by age. So ages 6 to 8, age 12, and I didn't include the second page here. So there were 2 full pages of names in most issues. And you had the kid's name and their address, and you could write to them. And when I first started finding these pen pal pages, I was really excited. But at one point, I actually had to stop myself for an evening because as I was scanning the names, I realized that I was seeing several names in a row for kids who were interred in some of the Japanese relocation camps. So these were kids who were closed off from pretty much everything in the world, who were looking for other kids to talk to write to. This is one of my favorite things, the Wiz Comics Trading Post. This is like an early Craigslist for kids. Pretty cool, you could write in, you could say what you had to trade and what you wanted. And so a lot of the trades are for things like BB guns and, you know, rock collections and big little books. One industrious kid I found, he was willing to trade a cow for a wagon or a sled. And this kid was a newspaper boy in one of the Dakotas. And so he wanted something to haul his newspapers around with for delivery. But as I read that, all I could think was, oh my God, what does his parents think if someone actually took him up on this? You know, you have to mail a cow? Where? And how that happened. There were lots of contests. So this is one of my favorite. This is in an early Archie Comics publication when Archie was still MLJ. And kids could write in a little letter and send a photograph. And the winning entrant had their picture drawn by the Archie staff. And so this is a young woman from Seattle named Alice Ng. And most of the drawings, the artist make the kids look a little bit older and more sophisticated than they are. Kind of nice, though. And then you can see a facsimile of her letter at the top as well. So tons and tons and tons of stuff like this. Fan clubs, different kinds of groups you could join and get certificates. Kids were also beginning to collect comics and think about reselling them. They were very enterprising early on. So the photo is one of my favorites, this enterprising kid who's selling comics and big little books for 5 cents a piece. And you can see that he's got a girl in front of the stand. I love the little umbrella that he has hooked up there. You can see this boy who is collecting and selling old comic books for 1 cent for the oldest. 1 cent. Wow. That's from 1948 to 7 cents for the most recent editions. In 2 months, he had made $6. Not bad. So kids were going into business, and this wasn't isolated. There were lots of kids who were doing similar things. Not all of them got written about in newspapers. There were some kids who were setting up stands like these and giving money to the war bond efforts in the early 1940s. There's a woman here who started up a comics library in her home, and so this is a photo of kids who were coming to visit, and they also got to eat homemade cookies while they sat there. You know, so kids are coming together, reading comics together. At different points, too, kids began to do some really amazing things in terms of sort of social justice kinds of activities. So let me talk about this girl on the left first. Her name is Louise Crutcher. She died a few years ago, but in the early 1940s, she was growing up on the south side of Chicago. She's African American. And she was on the bus one weekend, and she happened to sit next to another young woman who had recently been discharged from some sort of children's home or hospital. And in having a conversation with this other girl, what Louise realized is that there were kids who were in foster homes and hospitals and orphanages and other kinds of institutions who didn't have access to comics. And remember, kids wanted to do nothing more than read comics at this point. And Louise thought, you know, she needed to do something about this. And so she gathered up all of the comics that she had. She went around the neighborhood and started scrounging comics that she could find. She taped them and stapled them back together if she had to. She got donations, including from the boxer Joe Lewis. And she gathered up a library of several hundred comics. And what she began to do then was every Saturday she had a route that she would make on the public bus system. She would go to these orphanages and foster homes and hospitals in the area and check comics out to kids. She had her own library. And it was really a library. You could put requests in. You could put holds on things. You would sign out a card to indicate what kind of comic you had. And she would make the rounds. And she was doing this not just for black kids, but for white kids, whoever was in these different facilities. And I think that's pretty awesome. There were kids like the kids on the right who were part of a group called Youth Builders, which was, they were based in the New York City area. And these were middle school aged kids who were a mixed race group, but they all were reading Captain Marvel comics at the time. Captain Marvel was enormously popular. And one of the characters in Captain Marvel was this African-American character named Steamboat. As you can see, Steamboat is sort of crudely portrayed. This is pretty much what African-American characters looked like in the early to mid-1940s in comics. But Steamboat was one of the few African-American characters in comics, and these kids were really frustrated that anyone who might open Captain Marvel and see Steamboat, that this is what they're going to see as a depiction of African-Americans. And so they wrote to Fawcett, said they wanted Steamboat to go away. Then they showed up at the Fawcett Comics office in New York City. They got into an appointment with the editor and publisher, Will Lieberson. And they said, we don't like the way you're portraying Steamboat. You think that Steamboat needs to go? And Lieberson said, oh, no, you don't understand. You know, this is okay. And the kids stayed, and they argued for what was wrong with Steamboat. And finally, Lieberson said, okay. And that was the end of Steamboat. So this is a group of middle school age kids who just showed up and changed. You know, maybe it would have been better if they had been able to persuade him for a more positive depiction, but they were able to make a difference. Now, I include this image here because in an article from a high school English teacher in Florida in the early 1950s, there's a story that the teacher tells. They're doing a unit on racism, which I think is pretty awesome for Florida in the early 1950s. And they had had several days with debates in the classroom. And the next to the last day, one of the kids, I think he was a junior in high school, asked if he could bring something in to read to his classmates. And the teacher said yes. And so the next day, the kid brings in a comic. And he reads this story from EC Comics. EC was one of the most popular publishers in the early 1950s. And the story is about a Korean War vet who has narrowly missed being killed. And his best friend and fellow soldier has actually died sort of in his place. He threw himself on a mortar or landmine that was exploding and saved the man you see in the panels. And the soldier had asked that his parents bury his friend who had given his life for him in the family plot in the cemetery. And so he returns, he thinks this is what's happened, and he returns home from his service, and he discovers that his family hasn't abided by his wishes. And he's being feted as a hero, and there's this big celebration planned, and he shows up at the celebration to lecture folks. He says, but when his body was sent back here, it wasn't good enough to be buried in Fairlawn. It wasn't good enough because its skin wasn't the right color. So it was an African-American man who had given his life. He says, well, the grenade that tore that skin to pieces didn't know its color, didn't care if it was white or black. What did he die for? What did I give my arm for? You say you're proud of me. Well, I'm not proud of you. I'm ashamed. I'm ashamed of you and for you. And the teacher writes that as this young man finishes reading the story, that his classmates just fell silent. And that this was the moment, you know, this was like the moment this teacher had been waiting for in the debate. And it was because this young man shared an EC comic story. EC was well known for both its gore, but also for being sort of socially progressive. It had stories about racism, about spousal abuse and about other difficult issues in the 1950s. And I think that's really important to think that comics can be used as a vehicle to change ideas. There were kids being creative with and around comics. You all know who Margaret Atwood is? Margaret Atwood drew this. She was about 7. This is the Blue Bunny comics by Peggy. Margaret Atwood still draws comics. She draws little sketches of her book tours and speaking engagements, but she was a child of the 1940s like so many others, and she drew lots of comics. She wasn't the only one. Lots of kids made their own comics, including this kid who had, I think they were printing like 500 issues of his comic that he drew in South Carolina. He sent some to his state representatives and, you know, was selling them to his friends. I think he was selling them for a nickel, but still pretty awesome. There were kids like Bob Stewart. Now, Bob Stewart is this young man, and when he was growing up in the early to mid-1950s in Kirbyville, Texas, he started some of the first comics fanzines. This is his, the EC Fan Bulletin. I mentioned a few minutes ago that EC was a really popular publisher of comics in the 1950s, and it drew a devoted fan following. Bob published these fanzines with Hectograph, and if you don't know what Hectograph is, it involves gelatin and a tray and ink and a stencil, and you press one sheet at a time. And you can get maybe, if you're really lucky, 50 good copies off of a stencil. If you stretch it, you can get maybe 70 or 80, but they won't be very readable by the time you get to that point. But he was writing these fanzines, and it wasn't just him. He had a network of subscribers and contributors who sent him stuff. So Bill Spicer contributed the cover image. Bill Spicer has gone on to be a well-known comics historian. Bob himself grew up to write for comics, edit comics. He grew to be an authority on the EC artist Wally Wood. And he wrote for places like the Comics Journal. And this was a child, a young fascination to publish this kind of stuff. Bob died just about a year and a half ago. I got to become acquainted with him and have a number of phone conversations with him in the last couple of years he was alive. And he's just a wonderful man. And I can't say enough about him. And you can see that's one of his cartoons too on the blackboard. Now, kids were doing lots of awesome things with comics. They were reading and playing and creating and trying to change their corners of the world. But parents, teachers, librarians, religious leaders, law enforcement officers, social workers, doctors, if you can name an adult profession of some kind, you can probably count on them being opposed to comics at some point in the late 1940s and early 1950s. There were local and statewide bans on comics proposed. There were attempts to put publishers out of business, to curb all kinds of comics from the shelves in newsstands and drugstores. There were articles in all kinds of professional journals. This is one of my favorite titles, "Youth Librarians Can Defeat Comics." This is from the late 1940s. Those of you who are librarians in the room know that being a librarian today is all about intellectual freedom and about standing up to oppose censorship. In the late 1940s, Jean Grey Harker, who was a librarian in Wisconsin, was saying, "Good librarians will work with their state's legislators to ensure that comics are banned from the newsstands." So it wasn't the same environment then as it is now. This is Sterling North. Sterling North was a children's author. He wrote the book Rascal and some others, won a Newbery Award. In the 1940s, he was a literary critic in Chicago, and it's actually his article for the Chicago Sun-Times that sort of launched the avalanche of criticism against comics. He called them a hypodermic injection of sex and violence. And his editorial was reprinted lots and lots and lots and lots of times, millions of times. And the rhetoric he used in that editorial actually spurred a lot of the criticism of comics for the next decade and a half. So even the people who may not have attributed their ideas to North borrowed his language. And then there's this guy. This is my friend, Frederick Wortham. Frederick Wortham was a German-American psychiatrist. He came to the US in the 1920s to study with the renowned psychiatrist Adolf Meyer at Phipps Hospital in Baltimore. And by the early 30s, he was working in New York City. He was well-respected. He did a lot of work for the court system. He was the head of psychiatric services at several New York area hospitals, wrote lots of books. He developed an interest in forensic psychiatry, so one of his early cases of interest was with a guy named Fish. I think it was Adolf Fish now, I can't remember his first name, who was a serial killer, a cannibalistic serial killer at that. And in the 1940s, Wortham actually grew to be more progressive. He was still interested in forensics, but he was even more interested in issues of poverty and race and general, what he would call social and mental hygiene. So creating the right environment for people to live in, to create the optimal conditions for good mental health. And as part of his efforts in this area, he worked with several African-American leaders to set up the first psychiatric clinic in Harlem. He was called Dr. Corder because anyone could walk in and see him for 25 cents. He had an army of volunteers, social workers and medical doctors and nurses and others who would work with kids and adults who came through this clinic in Harlem. They would go to court with you to help you out in court cases for $2. That cost a little extra. But still, it was the first psychiatric service available to folks in Harlem. But through this clinic in Harlem and through his other practice, he began to notice that kids were reading comics. Oh my God. I told you that 95 or 96% of kids read comics. Wortham was seeing kids who were identified as juvenile delinquents or had other similar mental health issues, anything from bedwetting to truancy to petty theft to sexual precocity, you know, whatever it happened to be, everything got tossed at him. And these kids all read comics. And for Wortham, some light bulb went off that said, oh, these kids are all reading comics. Comics must make them bedwetters and daydreamers and juvenile delinquents and truants and a whole host of other things. He didn't really say that, but that's sort of the undercurrent of his work. And beginning in the late 1940s, he started writing, publishing, speaking about this relation that he saw, relationship he saw between comics and juvenile delinquency. And he published widely in places like Ladies' Home Journal and Reader's Digest. He was on the radio a lot if you were in the New York City area. He got the ear of powerful people, including the senator from Tennessee, Estes Kefauver, who was head of the Senate Judiciary Committee in the early 1950s. And beginning in 1950 and then again in 1954, Wortham spoke to the Senate to tell them about the evils of comics, which he had seen firsthand from these kids that he had treated. Now, as Wortham is writing this stuff, getting it published, and stepping out and talking about these issues, there were kids who were beginning to read things in Reader's Digest and Ladies' Home Journal and thinking, you know, this doesn't sound right. I read comics and I don't think I'm a delinquent. And they began to write to Wortham. Now, not hundreds or thousands of kids, but dozens of kids wrote to Wortham around 1953, 54, and 55. And one of them is this young woman here, Opal Noble, from Bisbee, Arizona. And she corresponded with Wortham for several months on behalf of her classmates. They were talking about comics and reading Wortham's Reader's Digest article in their class in Bisbee. And so she corresponded with Wortham as the class secretary. And Wortham knew he had a captive audience, and so he sort of nurtured this conversation, so much so that in the second letter, he sent them a box of chocolates from Macy's. Now, I spoke with Opal a couple of years ago, and she said that the kids in Bisbee were not well-off kids. There were a lot of poor kids. Bisbee's a mining community in the mountains of southeastern Arizona. And there were enough chocolates in the box so that everyone in the class got one. And she said that for some of the kids, that was the first time they'd ever seen chocolate in a box like that. And that some of her classmates made their one piece of chocolate last the whole day. They were amazed by this. And Wortham wanted them to tell him about their impressions of comics, and in particular about the character Green Arrow, who wasn't a very nice character. And so they corresponded several times, and then that was the end of it. A lot of kids were more like this young man, Brian McLaughlin, who wrote to Wortham, as only 11-year-old can. Anybody that goes out and kills someone because he read a comic book is a simple-minded idiot. And then he goes on to critique Wortham. Does that sound silly? Well, so do you. And there were mostly letters like this from kids as young as 7 and up to early college students who wrote to him to say, you know, I don't know who you're talking to, but we're not like those kids. We're normal, we're okay. There's something wrong. Why haven't you thought about these other factors like home life or poverty or things like that as you talk about the evils of comics? I mentioned a minute ago that Wortham talked with the Senate Judiciary Committee, and the big hearings about comic books were in 1954. The Senate had 3 days of hearings about the evils of comics. And Wortham was the star witness. And just a quick shout out for those of you who care. There's a little documentary about me. It's like 25 minutes. You can find it on YouTube. It's called Carol Tilly Comic Book Crusader. You can watch it for free. It's kind of fun. That's a piece of art from that documentary. But the Senate was really concerned that comics were leading America's kids, America's youth astray. And these hearings were fairly well publicized, although the Army-McCarthy hearings were going on at the same time, so that cut down a little bit on the publicity, but they were still written about across the country. And kids got to be worried, because there were rumors that the Senate was going to step in and ban comics or censor them somehow. And kids began to write to the Senate in the summer of 1954 and into the fall of that same year. There are several hundred letters in the National Archives. Not all of them are from kids, but most of them are. Not all of them are very articulate, but some of them are. And one of them is from this young man named Brian Mulholland. And he wrote a very poignant letter. He was 15 at the time, and he said, you know, censorship is something that happens in Russia, not here. This isn't what America is founded on. You know, I'm as good and true and pure as you would want your son to be, and I read comics. It's a really lovely letter. A couple of years ago, I tracked him down. He had just retired as an attorney in New Jersey. And when I sent him a copy of his letter and he reread it, he said, you know, I couldn't have written a better letter today. Now, that was him reflecting on his 15-year-old thoughts. And we talked for a long time on the phone, and I had just turned off the recorder, and we were still talking, and I really regret that I didn't have the recorder on, because he began to tell me, he said, you know, I was just talking with one of my sons, he had several grown sons, a few weeks ago about a comic I remember reading when I was maybe 13. And he begins to tell me, panel for panel, his memory of this comic. dialogue. He can tell me what's in the panels. And he talks for maybe 10 minutes telling me this story. And as he's talking, I realize, at least I think I realize, what story it is. And I checked myself when I got off. He told me panel for panel about the EC story Judgment Day, which is this wonderful, hard space story about an astronaut who's sent to investigate another civilization, and whether or not the Earth should start relations with this other civilization. And he sees that they don't treat each other equally, that they have a prejudice against different members of their species. And he is, you know, he believes that he shouldn't argue that trade and relations should be established. And in the last couple of panels, he takes his helmet off to reveal that he's African American. Now, this story had stayed with Brian Mulholland for 60 years. He hadn't read it since he was 13. And so that's another example I see of sort of the power of comics. This young man also wrote to the Senate. He said, you know, we don't read comics because we are juvenile delinquents. We don't read comics because we want to kill people. We read comics because they're fun, because the stories are great, because the art is great. They're just awesome. And that kid is Phil Proctor. He was 13. Phil Proctor grew up. He became a founding member of the Fire Sign Theater. And if you don't know the Fire Sign Theater, it's the closest thing I can say is it's America's Monty Python. Wonderful satirical group. And he told me that really what happened with comics in the early to mid-1950s was what spurred him to become a satirist. He said that that episode with Kefauver and Wortham in the hearings, it said, made him want to grow up, quote, to stick it to those blue-nosed, tight-assed censors who tried to take his comics away from him. So there were kids like him who wrote. There were kids like Abe Hoffman, who grew up in LA and still lives there. He's a retired history professor, but when he was 16, he showed up at the LA County Council meeting. LA was considering banning the sale of comics even after the Senate hearings happened. And he showed up and he testified at the council meetings to say, you know, look, I've got hundreds of these in my garage at home. And by the way, haven't you ever read any Grimm's fairy tales and folk tales? You know, those are horribly more violent than anything you might find in comics. The Senate didn't do anything. They issued a report, but they decided not to censor comics. But publishers got really antsy. They were afraid that if they didn't do something, that the government may still step in. So publishers founded the Comics Code Authority, which was a self-censorship body. If you wanted your comics on newsstands in the US for sale, which there weren't any comic book shops really to speak of, there were one or two, you had to submit your art and story before publication to the Comics Code Authority, where they had a room of really little old former school teachers and librarians. I say that delicately, but they were little old former school teachers and librarians who would look at your story and they would say, no, you have to change this, you have to change this, you have to redo this, you can't show that. And until you got their stamp on the page, you weren't able to publish. The Comics Code Authority was in effect until February of 2011. Yeah. By the time it ended in February 2011, the only publisher who was still submitting anything was Archie, but it didn't really have any weight. Now, the Comics Code Authority could have been fairly benign, but it wasn't. The Comics Code in 1954 said that you can't have any comics about zombies, vampires, or werewolves. You can't show people who have physical disabilities or differences. We'd really like not to see women or people of color because those are problematic. We don't want slang or bad grammar unless it's absolutely necessary. We don't want you to show crime unless the criminal is punished. We don't want you to show extramarital affairs of any kind, and not more than a chaste kiss. if you have to. And there were lots and lots and lots of rules. And that code was amended several times. But what it did was it shut down a lot of the creativity, a lot of the innovation that existed in the comics world at that time. And subsequently, it sort of made sales tank. Not a good thing. Publishers began in the 60s to look for ways that they didn't have to sell to kids on the newsstand, so that by the time I was growing up in the early 1970s, there really wasn't anything for kids to read. It was crap. I mean, Richie Rich is fun, but you know, how much Richie Rich can you read after a while? And over the years, over the decades, a lot of comics fans have parodied and pilloried Frederick Wortham, even though he didn't cause the Sinaiterians or he didn't cause the Comics Code. He still is seen as a giant boogeyman because he was so vocal in his critique of comics. He died in the early 1980s, and his work, his manuscripts, his notes, all of his personal papers were given to the Library of Congress. And they were closed until 2010.
Wow.
Amazing. I have never heard of an embargo like this before on personal papers, but they sat there for 30 years and no one could look at them. And there is a dispute about why that happened, and the people involved contradict each other. So whatever happened, it happened. And in 2010, they finally said, you know, we're really going to open it up this time. Come on. And so I made an appointment. I went out not because I care about Frederick Wortham. Frederick Wortham is, you know, he is what he is. But I wanted to learn more about the teachers and librarians who he said had written to him. And so I wanted to look through his papers. There are 200 boxes of stuff there. It's a lot of stuff. And not all about comics, but 30-ish boxes about comics. And what I discovered pretty much on day one is that he kind of made things up. And I kept looking and looking and looking and realized over time, and I kept doing a lot of textual comparison, but he was changing things about the kids who he treated. He was changing their words, their ages, the comics that they read. He was embellishing the stories that they told him. He was leaving really important stuff out. So the stuff that creates the bulk of the evidence for his ideas in Seduction of the Innocent, the book that links, for all intents and purposes, comics reading and juvenile delinquency, has a lot of problems. And I sat on this for a while because I didn't want to be the person to write this article. But after a while, I realized, you know, kids are important, and a lot of times we discount what they have to say, we discount their experiences. And those kids that Wortham treated in the 1950s most of them came from very marginalized communities, very marginalized families and experiences. And that's not right. It's not right to distort what these kids who were in very precarious situations had to say. And so I wrote an article that was published in a boring scholarly journal that got picked up and made its way into the New York Times and all over the internet. And it's been kind of cool the last couple of years. Jim at the back calls me a comics rock star. I don't know if that's true, but yeah. I've had fun. And it's helped what I hear from comics readers, what I hear from comics creators, some of whom were comics creators in the 1950s when all of this went down, is thank you. You know, even though we thought all along that there were problems, thank you for redeeming us. Thank you for redeeming our experiences. And what I've been trying to do, and this is sort of out of place, sorry about that, this is proportionally comic sales in 1953. That's today. This includes floppies, manga, trade paperbacks. If you can print it on paper, that's what that includes. So, and I did the math, so that really is proportional. But what I've been working on the last couple of years are a couple of projects to help reclaim the stories of these young people that I shared with you early on. And I've got two projects right now. One is called the Comic Book Readership Archive with a colleague at Indiana and another colleague at Illinois. And we're starting with Marvel Comics in the 1960s and early 1970s, but we're trying to sort of restore information about letter writers, about fan club members. And we're starting with this limited period, but we're going to build beyond that. We have some grant money to get us started, and we're having a lot of fun. One of the best, I know I'm about out of time, but one of the best things I found, a couple of months ago, we were at Michigan State taking photographs of letters pages. And in a Millie the Model comic from about 1965, there was a letter from a 15-year-old boy. A Millie the Model is about as girly as you can expect. It's all about hairstyles and clothing. And there was this wonderful letter from this 15-year-old boy who said, "You know, I want you to know that you have boy readers too. And when I graduate from high school, I'm going to become a beautician. And so I want you to know how important this comic is to me, because I've learned things about hair and clothes." And I was really amazed to find this letter in a 1965-66 comic. And I started looking for this young man, and I didn't find him, but I found his brother, who said, "You know, he did grow up to be a hairdresser and cosmetologist and a gorgeous drag queen. He died in the early 90s of AIDS. But, you know, I heard from a second brother soon after that, and they were just amazed that I had found this letter. They didn't know about it. And it brought back to them a part of their brother that was, you know, that was redeeming. And I think there are probably more kids like that out there. The response that they got from the editors of Millie the Model was very positive. It was, "Thank you, and, you know, we hope that you follow your dreams." I'm also working on what I call the secret history. And this is a more personal project where I'm kind of pulling together into a bigger social and cultural history what it meant to be a child reading comics in the 1940s and 50s. And there's lots of great stuff out there, and I have lots more stories I want to tell. But that will have to wait for another time. If I have something to leave you with today, it's this. Comics were the biggest print medium of the 20th century. Easily, the biggest medium of the 20th century. Millions and millions and millions and millions of kids read comics and loved them and found inspiration and played with them and wrote them, collected them, traded them. And as adults, we did our best to squash that. We didn't like it. We were worried that it would turn kids into degenerates, into illiterates, into people who were unable to be good civic participants. And I think that the fact that all of you are sitting in this room today, that we have something like the Kids Read Comics Con, means that that's really not the case, that comics are something to be celebrated. What I would encourage you to think about is, what are we doing this to now? What are the media? What are the technologies that we are poo-pooing, that we are trying to deter kids from spending time with because we think they're going to turn kids into illiterates, degenerates, you know, poor citizens? So think about that. Be on the watch for those media, those technologies, and fight against that impulse, because there may be another comics out there. There may be something that would blossom into something even more fantastic than we could imagine if we weren't trying to get rid of it. And the second thing is, if you know of stories of people, not necessarily about comics, but do what you can to keep kids' voices alive. You know, so when you see little self-created comics from your 8-year-old, or videos of songs that your 10-year-old created, whatever it is, don't throw that away. Celebrate it. Save it. Save it for people like me, because we need to tell these stories. We need to tell the experience of childhood so that it's not forgotten and so that kids' lives and experiences are valued. And so I'll leave you with that, and thank you, and I'm happy to answer questions if there's time.
Yes.
So I wondered if, for instance, high school newspapers are places where students wrote about comics, because very often newspapers are where, you know, kids write and they learn editing and all that, and so if they had these strong feelings, they might have written in high school newspapers.
I think there are going to be examples of that. I found a few, maybe not kids writing about their experience with comics, but you can find kids creating comics in their high school yearbooks and newspapers, that kind of thing. So it is on my radar, but all of this stuff is so hard to get to, and there's so much of it and so hard to get to at the same time.
I was curious about the continued gender stereotyping of who reads comics and who doesn't read comics, and how that's continuing to affect sales. Moving to another medium that kids interact with in cartoons, Young Justice, which was probably the best thing based off DC Comics ever, was canceled literally because, according to Cartoon Network executives, too many girls were watching it.
Right.
And My Little Pony's Friendship is Magic is in its fifth season largely because boys are watching
right.
it.
Right.
How is that idea that boys are the one who drive the market continuing to determine what gets published, what doesn't get published, and how much that is continuing to keep comic sales depressed?
I think with DC and Marvel, it's absolutely a huge factor still. I think DC and Marvel, who account for 80%+ of all comic sales in the US, very much feed into the gender stereotyping, despite some efforts like Ms. Marvel and the female Thor and whatever else you want to point to. I think independent publishers understand that there is an important girls and women audience in comics. One of the things that I usually point to is even though it's not for kids, the Comixology survey from a couple of years ago that showed that, you know, their average purchaser is actually women, not men. So I think that new platforms, digital comics, web comics, are the way for women to get back into comics. Last
actually,
one.
The question was
yeah.
in digital comics, do those sales figures also include digital sales?
No, because those are really hard to track. They do include digital sales, but not like web comic merchandise, that kind of stuff. But digital comic sales.
Web comics are really kind of a big thing these days.
Absolutely. So it doesn't include things like Kickstarter. It doesn't include the folks who are monetizing their web comics in different ways. This is just sort of the print stuff, the traditional print stuff that's more easily captured.
All right,
so,
thank you,
Carol.
Thank you. 5 minutes to set up the panel. And we're about 5 minutes for coffee, use the facilities, but we're going to start back up in 5 minutes. I mean it. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you. Awesome.
You're very welcome.
All right, so what we got?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I had a real quick question.
Yeah.
I'm just documenting all of this.
Sure.
We're in the beginning of the school buckets.
Yes.
Record that by the ones who
right.
get you here. Do you mind if I grab your PowerPoint presentation just to review the individual slides?
No,
so
we don't.
I don't know what stipulations. I can tell
yeah,
them, like, don't you dare use anything about this presentation, but I just, I'm literally just handing over.
Yeah.
So if you don't mind, I'd love to do that.
Absolutely.
Thank you so
absolutely.
Much.
Hi. I would love to talk to you. My name's Kathleen, and I have a...
Hey, Dave,
yeah.
Is there a moderator for the panel?
There's supposed to be. He hasn't shown up yet.
Oh, okay.
So we're taking out just the hair.
All right. You can do it, right?
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
What were you doing with that?